Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Life Science Rundown. This is Nicholas Kapman with the FDA Group. Before we jump into our discussion for today, just a little bit about the FDA Group. We help life science companies in the areas of quality assurance, regulatory affairs, clinical operations, commissioning, qualification, and validation, as well as CMC. We offer three different engagement models, which are consulting, staff augmentation, and full-time employee recruitment. So if you ever find yourself in need, just head over to thefdagroup.com to check us out and get in touch. So today I am talking with George Toscano, the president and CEO of TCG Consulting. Hey, George, how's it going?
Good, Nicholas. How are you?
I'm doing excellent. I appreciate you joining me today. So we're going to be, for this call, talking about recent FDA enforcement trends. And I know you and I had talked a little bit about some of the things that we were going to go over today. But before we jump into the topic, could you just introduce yourself, your background, and so on?
Sure. Yeah, so my name is George Toscano. I have been in the pharmaceutical, biologics, medical device industries now for about 26, 27 years. And I would say about half of that has been in a consulting capacity. So I started my career originally as an analytical development chemist, working for pharmaceutical companies. And I did stints both with ANDA generic companies, as well as NDA for, you know, NDA prescription drug companies as well. Started out in analytical research, QC and analytical research in the laboratory. So mostly lab work. And then I moved into quality. And then I moved into regulatory. So I got to see a little bit of all these different things. And I also had the benefit of working at a lot of small companies, startups. There was companies where I was employee number 8, right? And so we did everything from unloading an HPLC from the cargo deck all the way to, you know, helping with a regulatory submission, right? So I think that was a nice thing in terms of broadening my my perspective and my experience is to work at small companies because you get to do a little bit of everything, right? And that's just by necessity. So after moving into, you know, quality and regulatory, then I moved into consulting. And the consulting started about 13 years ago. And it was really helping with companies that were under consent decree. Doing that, I got to know consultants, and then I just basically went into consulting and I haven't turned back since. So I worked for a lot of the big consulting houses, and about 5 years ago, I started up my own consulting practice, and we focus on quality and regulatory work as well. So I've been all over the world, I don't know how many times over, and I've seen, you know, the inside of probably over 100, 150 pharmaceutical biologics device companies at this point. So.
Okay, well, I think that background will lend itself well to what we're going to talk about today. So that's great. So let's start with kind of the first question. What are some recent items that the FDA has been citing in their inspections?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So, you know, when COVID started, we got a lot of new entrants into the market, into this pharmaceutical space. And I think it all started with the hand sanitizer people. And so what you had is a lot of people who had no idea what GMPs were, good manufacturing practices were. And I think they saw this as an opportunity either to help the public, you know, for the public good, or as an opportunity, you know, for financial advancement, whatever it was. They got into a space that they were not very well accustomed to working with, right? Mm. And so when FDA would look at these companies, either through inspection or through remote review document request, you know, they found that there was significant amount of deficiencies there. I mean, just to give you some examples of that, you know, most of these hand sanitizers have alcohol, ethanol alcohol or what have you. And so these companies were putting in methanol, mm-hmm. they were putting in yep. benzene, they were putting all kinds of different things. And so that was one thing. But I think that trend is starting to die down now. What I'm starting to see now is more around diethylene glycol and ethylene glycol, not adequately testing for those, right? So the FDA has been kind of looking at this issue for many years now. In fact, the first guidance came out probably 15 years ago, and it was the limit of diethylene glycol in these high-risk components. And the FDA has subsequently issued a new guidance this year, updated guidance. And basically, the reason why is because, I mean, this issue goes back probably hundreds of years, 100 years, where diethylene glycol was used in cough syrups, right? And a lot of the children who take these cough syrups end up getting sick, right? End up in hospital. And these things happen. It seems like every 10 or so years, you hear of this, another big case of diethylene glycol poisoning or ethylene glycol poisoning. And so FDA is harping on companies now, making sure that they are testing their incoming components for these two impurities, right? Because they shouldn't be in there. They're contaminants. So that's a big issue that's popping up. Another one that I see, which is somewhat unusual, but I mean, it's kind of linked to that. It is the quality unit, right? The, you know, QC and QA not having the authority, you know, the adequate authority to execute their tasks, right? And I think this one is popping up almost in conjunction with the first one. And I think it kind of makes sense because a lot of the companies that we're seeing these warning letters come from are generally OTC manufacturers, which in general don't have as robust a quality organization or knowledge or experience. And so the quality unit is not as well defined. And sometimes, you know, they don't even know or they're not aware of certain guidances that exist, right? And also sometimes they don't have a structure set up like we're used to seeing where quality is an independent unit that has its own responsibility for release and testing, right? And, you know, so these two kind of go hand in hand, which makes sense why they're not even testing for the diethylene glycol, right? So so those two are kind of things that we're seeing over and over again in warning letters. And the third thing is now there's more of a focus on ophthalmic products. So FDA started to pick up on ophthalmic products. And I think part of that is because of the recent contamination issues that we've seen with you know, microbial contamination in ophthalmic products. So as in terms of dosage forms, those are the ones that I'm seeing kind of pop up a lot as well.
Yeah. Kind of my perspective on it is the FDA, I call them waves. So in my, you know, 17 years in consulting, the waves are 18 to 24 months, right? So there was a big focus on products that were supposedly removing heavy metals from the body. There was data integrity issues, primarily in India. And then to kind of your point, I felt like the OTC and the cosmetic manufacturer, that was the wave that was happening right before COVID. And to your point, a lot of their products are not regulated. Maybe 10% of their products are regulated. And I think what ended up happening is the FDA had been in enough facilities to kind of see that this is a larger problem where, you know, people think just because 10% of their products are regulated and, you know, they have one sunscreen, quality isn't that important. And then I think that's kind of what, and so what, to your point, it sounds like that wave was paused during COVID and now is restarting. You also mentioned ophthalmics as maybe being that next wave. I'm just curious to ask you, are there any other potential waves you would expect are going to be coming?
It's interesting. I think I'm not sure if I can anticipate, you know, when we look at what I primarily do is I look at warning letters. And the unfortunate thing with warning letters is that they're kind of a lagging indicator, right? So a company gets inspected by the agency and typically a warning letter on the, you know, on the pharma drug biologic side, typically a warning letter, you know, takes about 6 months to get issued following that inspection, right? So what the agency is seeing on the floor right now, you know, we'll know in 6 months, right? Mm. 3 to 6 months. So what I do know is kind of the dosage form that is of interest is the ophthalmics now in recent history. But you know, the overall general trend, when I look at biologics, drugs, and devices, I tend to see that drugs have the worst scorecard in terms of compliance relative to biologics and devices, right? They tend to have the majority of adverse inspection outcomes in terms of being OAI, right? Official action indicated. Typically it ranges around 8 to 12%, which is really high, right? In terms of inspections that result in OAI, that's really high.
That is high.
Whereas, biologics, on the other hand, is 1% or less. Mm-hmm. So their maturity, if you will, from a quality system perspective, is much higher. And devices fall somewhere in the middle, but they still tend to be better than drugs. And I think part of what impacts the drugs is the OTC segment, right? Because mm-hmm. that's where we start to see right. a lot of the compliance issues. So
yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The only other thing I was going to mention before I kind of want to transition is, I know you and I look a lot at warning letters, but you know, there's also 483s, and while you know you need a FOIA in order to get access to it, you can still kind of see what it's pertaining to. So is there anything that you've seen as you just kind of peruse some of the 483s that have come out that would lead you to believe that next wave is coming? Have there been any trends?
Yeah, it's hard for me to say that there's a discernible trend. I mean, one of the things that I see that is I'll call it a perennial trend, and it is something that extends beyond waves. So, you know, data integrity came as a wave, and I would say that wave was a macro wave, right? It was multi-years, and it to some extent, it's still going on. But I would say the heyday of data integrity issues were, you know, a few years back. Not to say it's still not an issue, but I think one of the items that is a perennial favorite of the FDA to cite is failure to do adequate investigations.
That is
an item that you can look 10 years ago, and it was one of the top five findings. You can look 10 years before that, same thing. And you can look probably in the next 10 years, failure to do adequate investigations will be another top finding, right? That coupled with, lack of procedures, lack of written procedures or failure to follow procedure, that one's usually also a very high one as well.
So. Yeah, definitely following procedures seems to be the bigger bug, because if they're not written appropriately, it's hard to follow and it can negatively impact the business. And that's where you see a lot of non-compliance and following those procedures.
Yeah.
As it pertains to data integrity, I think I lost my train of thought, but that's fine. So we kind of talked about the wave of OTC manufacturers before COVID, and now it's either continue. Well, I would argue it paused because we had, you know, face masks, hand sanitizers, testing kits, all that kind of stuff. But it seems like that is probably restarting. What about the FDA inspection process? Because we obviously saw that changed during COVID. Have we returned to the way things were back in 2019? Have things evolved? What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, the first thing is there was a massive reduction in the number of inspections, right? So FDA, in terms of enforcement, right, in terms of on-site inspections, they just dropped by, I would say, half or more on the domestic side. And on the foreign side, it almost ceased almost. Mm-hmm. Right? There was still some inspections going on, but it was a drastic reduction. The FDA started to use a lot more of these remote tools where they either remote evaluations or document requests, right? I think that has changed. The number of FDA inspections has on-site inspections has ramped up again. It's still not at pre-pandemic levels, but it's getting there, right? Mm-hmm. But the FDA still uses a lot of these remote tools. So while they weren't using them as much, so, you know, 2019, it was mostly on-site inspections, right? On-site surveillance inspections or for-cause inspections, PAIs, that kind of stuff. And these remote requests were not as prevalent or not as widely used. Post-pandemic, even now that the FDA is returning to more of an on-site inspection approach, they're still using the remote records requests quite a bit. Mm. And in fact, they're issuing warning letters based off of not even on-site inspections, but remote requests.
They're either
being used or just based on the documents that they're getting, they're finding that the companies are not in compliance. And so they're using that as well. So,
which, you know, tell me if you disagree, but it sounds like it's a bit more efficient.
Yeah. I mean, you know, my take on it, you know, I've done I don't know, probably somewhere between 700 to 1,000 inspections in my career. And I've done remote inspections, you know, because that was the evolution, you know, the last couple of years. You know, there were certain times where just due to travel restrictions and companies' restrictions for being on site, there was no other option, right? Mm-hmm. And so I've done my share of remote inspections, and I've done, you know, a plethora of on-site inspections. I don't think that remote inspections are a substitute for on-site inspections.
No.
While they're more, you know, go ahead.
I would agree with that. My point was more toward the fact that there's no way the FDA can inspect everybody that they need to inspect in a time frame that is reasonable. So what I was imagining is if you do a remote inspection, request some documents, you can kind of do a sniff test relatively quickly. And if there's an indication that the records took too long to come, or there's some issues with the compliance, now maybe I want to dig in deeper and go do an on-site. But if I'm getting documents quickly and they're sufficient, and you know the company isn't prioritized or high risk, then maybe that's a good indicator that now I should shift instead of investing a lot of time going after or looking into a company that it really isn't going to turn up a whole lot.
Yeah, I would say to an extent there is some value in that. I think the value comes in if you do a request and somebody outright refuses to provide documents, right? That's that's already the first red flag, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a category that you establish just based on the request. The second one is if the quality of the documents is so subpar that they don't have certain statutory requirements in them, then again, that's already another signal that there's probably way more problems when I actually get on site just by virtue of what they're providing, right? So I think it's good as a tool to provide kind of a gross cut in terms of, you know, that. But I think, you know, for those companies where the documents look good, I would say that the utility starts to become a little bit different, because when you actually see on the ground, there is one thing to have a procedure that is okay, but there's the other thing is like, are you actually following the procedure?
True.
And how is it implementation, right? So I
That's
think-
true.
It's values on that gross cut, right?
Yeah, so. Yeah. And again, I think it's more of a sniff test. Obviously, you could get really good initial information, but there's still underlying compliance issues. But I think to both of our points, if that first step is throwing up flags, then really there should be an on-site visit. So, So what are some of the observations that the FDA is citing year over year and you can think we're going to continue to see?
So we talked about this already a little bit. I think that, you know, the investigations, right? The failure to do adequate investigations is one that we're going to continue to see. And I think there's a reason for that. You know, one of the dynamics that happens in pharma companies, which is kind of interesting, is there's this vicious cycle that I see, and it happens at every company, right? Almost every company, right? It is, you know, you manufacture a batch, right? And sometimes there's deviations associated with it, sometimes not, but more often than not, for very complex processes, especially on the biologic side, there's a number of deviations because the manufacturing process is so complex. But, you know, the same is true for drugs, simple drugs, you know, solid oral dosage, what have you. So there's a manufacturing process, there's in-process testing, and then there's, you know, finished product release testing on the drug side, in the laboratory. And if there is any kind of deviation or any kind of quality event or OOS, you know, out of specification result that is tied to that batch can't be released. Or, you know, I've seen companies release them, which is actually a very big compliance issue, but they should not be released until these are closed, right? And what I see often when I arrive at a company in a consulting capacity is, can you help us with this backlog of deviations, kappas, you name it, right? And they can have 100, 150, 200 backlogs of these things, right? And so what you get from management is, help me close these quality events so I can release batches. That's from the operational side. And then the quality side is, well, we're trying to close these, but you know, we don't have enough manpower, and that's why the consultants come in, right? But what ends up happening is to do a proper investigation, it takes time, right? Sometimes the issues are complicated, right? But there's all this pressure in order to get the batch released. So sometimes these investigations get closed without adequate root cause. And if there's no adequate root cause for why this issue occurred, then you can't really put in an appropriate corrective and preventative action to prevent it from happening again, right? And so then the investigation gets closed, the batch gets released, and then a month from now, same issue pops up again, right? And so that's why there's this vicious cycle of close it, I have to release the batch, I didn't fix it right, it comes up again, and this happens over and over and over again. And it's not tied to any one company, it's just an industry thing. And it's been going on for over 20 years, I mean, no, at least in my experience, so.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, first of all, when I lost my train of thought earlier in the conversation, this is exactly what I wanted to talk about. So I was viciously writing my notes and you covered everything I wanted to say. So so that was good. I'm just thinking, right, because it seems like there might be something systemic, which is we have to release this batch, right? We have to. And then there's that systemic pressure to try to get to what they think is root cause, and it's, oh, we have to retrain the operator, right? So how do we balance our ability to meet our business objectives and try to get to root cause as quickly as possible so we can release a batch while, you know, not undercutting ourselves and coming up with the same issues over and over because we incorrectly identify what the root cause was?
I think that's the question. That is the you know, the key question that this industry can use some guidance on. And you know, the thing is, not every investigation requires a completely thorough, you know, elaborate root cause. I mean, some things are pretty straightforward. You know, it's a clear cut thing. You know, for example, in a laboratory in OOS, if the results come out at 50% of what they're expected, well, you can look at the glassware. Oh, did they use the right flask? Did they use the right pipette? If you see that they used a 5 mil pipette instead of a 10 mil pipette, clear cut, right? We know what it is. There's you don't have to do a much more elaborate process beyond that. But when you have these issues that pop up in manufacturing, and there's you start to see trends in batches. I mean, some of these things are really complex. I've seen one where we had a product that was an emulsion, and they were using silastic tubing in the manufacturing process. And whenever they'd have a stop in the manufacturing process, the solution would stay in this tubing for a longer period of time, and it would start to absorb, right? And so then you start to see even within the batch, you know, this potency go down, come back up, and go down. And so these issues aren't, you don't figure them out right away. You have to do long investigation and kind of look at the data over multiple batches, right? So some of these you don't find out until much later when you have a bigger body of data. But, you know, it is hard to balance this thing, right? Where operations wants to get the batches released and quality wants to do an adequate investigation. I think it's applying the, you know, the level of rigor and time and having the right people. You know, people, you know, one of the things that I see is sometimes you'll have a quality investigation group that has never worked in manufacturing, never worked in the laboratory. And so when they're looking at these issues, you know, they just can't probe deep enough, right? In terms of, you know, helping with the investigation because they don't have enough expertise in what the you know, issue is, right? In my experience, the best investigators or the best people that conduct these investigations are people who come from the respective departments, right? And companies are set up differently. Some companies will have a QA group that's separate and initiates, you know, they're all involved in the investigations. So the laboratory or manufacturing will just be the initiator and transfer it over to this investigation group. Some companies, the investigator comes from the group itself, right? So it could be a laboratory person who was the initiator and also the primary investigator. So I think part of it is applying the rigor when appropriate, having the right people, involved in the investigation process, and you know, making sure that they have all the tools available to them, because root cause analysis, there's like 5, 6, 7 different tools you can use. Not all of them are appropriate. And some companies you'll see fall into the trap of, well, we use 5 whys for everything, right? And 5 whys is okay, but it's not always the best tool, right? Or, you know, we use, you know, whatever, 5Ms or whatever. So there's all these different tools, but their application is event specific, right? And even knowing when to do that is also an important piece. But this is a huge question, right? This is the big question, Nicholas, that I'm not going to solve. I mean, I can certainly give a lot of recommendations and guidance, and I can certainly leave a company much better off than when I find them. Mm. But, you know, to fix this issue is a big one, right? It's a big one.
You know what? Point taken. And at the same time, I think those are 3 points that we can highlight that can at least allow the audience to get a little bit closer, which is have the right amount of rigor, the right people, and the right tools. So when you're going into an investigation, evaluate those things before you begin. Make sure that you're in the best position to get to root cause. So while we didn't solve the systemic issue, I think we did give some good advice, or at least you did. So good job.
Yeah.
So, this is a common question. I get it all the time. I'm sure you do as well, is everybody's wondering, when is the FDA going to come? Right. there's more than one answer to that. I'll contribute to that answer as well, but why don't you take the first crack at it?
Sure. So first of all, FDA comes for a variety of different reasons in terms of they have different types of inspection programs, right? So FDA has a routine surveillance program, right? And so that's going to be an inspection that's routine, and it's risk-based based off of what dosage form you manufacture, what your compliance history with the FDA, and in its risk-based as well. So that's just a routine surveillance inspection. And that could be every 2 years, it could be longer, it depends, right? But that's one reason why the FDA come, just it's a normal course of business, right? Mm-hmm. The second thing is PAI inspections, for prior approval inspections. So if a company is submitting a drug application, part of what the agency does is a pre-approval inspection to make sure that they're commercial ready, to make sure that the data that they have on site matches with what has been submitted in the application. They also review for data integrity. And then recently they have quality system maturity model that they're looking for as well. So there's distinct objectives that the agency has for prior approval inspections, and they do conduct those, right? The third one is probably the more interesting one, is for cause inspections, right? And for cause inspections are typically when the agency is getting some signals that there is something, you know, some quality issues or some kind of issues that the agency has to go and take a look at. And this could be triggered through customer complaints, adverse events, field alerts, recalls, any of these, you know, triggers, or even FDA testing samples in the field, right? So any of these things can trigger for cause inspection, and that's not the exhaustive list, but those are some kind of the common things. But those are all kind of things that can lead the agency to show up at your doorstep.
Yep. You covered it all. So nice job again. One thing we were also talking about is the number of inspections that are domestic versus foreign. You and I both have access to the, everybody has access, but I think you and I probably look at the FDA dashboard and the warning letters a little bit more frequently than others. So you and I both know there's significantly more domestic inspections than foreign inspections, and therefore you're probably going to see a disproportionate amount or a proportionate amount of OAIs and VAIs domestically as opposed to foreign outside the United States. So what's your opinion as to, well, first let's quantify that. And then secondly, why do you think that is what it is?
Yeah, so, you know, it is a surprising thing. When I talk to most people, most of the assumption is, well, foreign manufacturers are going to have way more warning letters than domestic ones. And it's really not the case. And it's a function of the numbers, right? It's a numbers game. FDA conducts probably five times as many inspections domestically as they do, you know, in a foreign capacity. It's just because the foreign inspection cadre that the FDA has is smaller, right? It's much easier to inspect domestically. And it's a little harder to do it in a foreign capacity. So it's just a smaller number of inspections. So what you have as a result of that numbers game, because there's so many more opportunities, you have so many more warning letters issued domestically than you have in a foreign capacity. But that's not to say that the compliance of U.S. firms relative to foreign firms is worse. It's just if you inspect, you know, 5,000 versus, you know, 1,000, you're going to get more out of this bigger population set, right? But I think that is a surprising thing to most people because, you know, without knowing the disparity in inspections, the assumption is, well, these foreign firms are going to have higher warning letters, right? You know, and I think, you know, there's a lot of, I've been all around the world and there's a lot of foreign firms that are actually in very good shape. The facilities are excellent, pristine, and the compliance is very good. Understanding is good. And, you know, domestically, there's also, you have the same thing, but you also have some really poor old aging facilities. I mean, in the U.S., I've seen some facilities that have probably should have been decommissioned 20 years ago.
Yeah.
and they're still out there. And it's, you know, I think, you know, it's a function of the industry. I think some management, you know, they end up acquiring companies. A lot of these big pharma companies are like serial acquirers that they'll buy this outfit or that outfit. And I think that the management just says, well, we're going to get as much as we can out of this facility, and they'll put Band-Aids on and what have you, and kind of just don't do the necessary capital investment to bring a facility up to speed. They'll just see how long they can keep it cash flowing, you know, for them without sinking in a huge amount of capital. And I see that a lot in the U.S., probably more so than foreign. You know, foreign, you have some really nice facilities, the newer construction ones, and then you have some that are also pretty rough. So
yeah, and I think to your point, you see both foreign and domestically. For me, and you and I were talking about this, I think domestic inspections year to date FDA is just over 10,000, and then foreign inspections is just over 1,800. That's where you get the five times number. Just so everybody kind of has an idea, and then the OAIs and VAIs generally are going to track in relation to that number.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then just to your point, just some of the Band-Aids and things that people are willing to do. I saw a line and they broke the wall and the line went out of the building and went back in.
That's so crazy.
I know, some of these things make you catch your breath. You know, you just, how does that happen? And again, you see it both domestically and foreign.
Yeah, but I think, you know, that goes back to the point of, that's why it's important to get on site, you know, especially.
Yeah, you wouldn't have been able to,
You know, you wouldn't see that from a remote inspection, right?
And so, but then again, to your point, George, would they have good written procedures if they're willing to do something like that? I would argue probably not.
Who knows, right? It's hard to say. I mean, some companies will say, hey, give us, you know, they'll reach out to consulting firms and say, create some SOPs for us, right? Which I think is always a dismal idea, right?
Right.
You know, so they'll have procedures that they're not fit for purpose, but they read like, hey, they're in compliance with the regs, right? But if you get to the facility and you're like, well, you're making sterile ophthalmics, why is this stuff dripping from the ceiling into your filling line, right?
Yeah.
You won't see that with a remote review, right? So.
Yeah. Good point. I think before we wrap things up, you know, what are some recommendations that you would offer that would allow companies to prepare for their next FDA inspection?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the real answer to this question is you should always be prepared for an FDA inspection, right? So it's not a function of, well, we need to clean up, we need to, you know, do this, we need to, you know, bolster this, that, and the other. It should be, we're always in the state of commercial readiness because, and ready for an inspection, because this is the way we operate, right? So that's the desired goal, right? To be in a state where it's just business as usual, right? And so when inspection comes, great, just business as usual. That's the desired state. most companies, you know, are not there, or there is additional activities that they do in preparation of an inspection. And it could be somewhat situational, right? So if you have a brand new company, like a startup, and it's their first BLA or their first NDA, what have you, and a lot of the people there have never been through an FDA inspection, and they don't really know what the process is, one thing that might be helpful for them is to undergo like a mock PAI, you know, get a consulting firm with ex-FDA people and say, can you come through our facility, just so that the people who've never experienced this understand what it's going to be like. Mm-hmm. And they're not so kind of gun shy or, you know, nervous, if you will, during the actual inspection, because they kind of already know what to expect. So that's one thing that I think might be helpful. Even if you're in a good state of readiness, it's just the interaction with the inspector and kind of what to expect is helpful for a lot of people if they haven't ever gone through it. Right.
Yep. Excellent point. Any final thoughts you want to leave the audience with before we close?
No, I think, you know, hopefully this was helpful so that people can see what the FDA is kind of keying in on. And, no, nothing else. You know, it's consulting. I've been all around the world. It's been an interesting thing. And, you know, you get to see a lot of stuff. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Well, I think this was very insightful. And I'm hopeful that the audience was able to get a couple nuggets out of this. So thank you very much, George. And to everybody listening, as always, if you find conversations like this valuable, please share it with your colleague or professional network. If you haven't already, subscribe to get updates of new episodes at theftagroup.com/podcast and follow the FDA Group on LinkedIn. If you'd like to connect about project or resource needs, head over to theftagroup.com to get in touch, or feel free to connect with me personally on LinkedIn. And before we close, George, just if anybody wants to find you, what's the best way to reach out?
Oh, so you can find us. You can find me on LinkedIn, or you can find us. We're TCG, Toscano Consulting Group. You can find us at, I don't even know what the website address is. I think it's, you can just Google it and you'll find us. Or you can find me through my LinkedIn profile. So, okay. Yeah.
Fantastic. All right. Thank you, George. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in.